then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, a vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune. For your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon. With your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud walled cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely croon, and the thousand blades were flushing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's June the 27th, 2013. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Several weeks ago, I mentioned on this show that I had just learned that I had a great-great-grandfather named Elijah Covington Sr., who died in 1865 in a Union prisoner of war camp on Hart's Island, New York, not Governor's Island like I originally thought. A number of you responded favorably to that brief segment on the show, but I would like especially to thank Comrade Michael and his wife, who live in New York City and who went out to the Cypress Hill Cemetery in Brooklyn and photographed my great-great-grandfather's grave with a Confederate flag and a Northwest tricolor in front of the stone. They also sent me a panoramic view of the cemetery showing the hundreds of small gravestones of Confederate dead who are buried there and who, like my ancestor, never made it out alive. It was a lovely gesture, and I deeply appreciate it. I forwarded some of those photos to the Northwest Revolution List to share them with the rest of you guys. Now, moving on, I received a somewhat critical email from a listener, which I won't read out loud here, but which I will summarize as follows. This comrade objects that I am discussing things on this show that should never be discussed in public because we have a wide variety of enemies listening to the podcast, from the FBI to the Goat Dancers, and I'm giving too much away thereby. I'm sure that there are other listeners who feel the same way, so let me run this one down for you guys again. Yes, you're right. There are people listening to this show who should not be, but there's not much that anyone can do about it. I like it or not, and I don't like it much, the internet is our major medium of communication. And realistically, that means that our multifarious enemies can intercept and monitor pretty much everything we do. They can even monitor my organizational letters if the special agent in charge can get some of those useless boys and girls in $2,000 suits he's got working for him to get their asses up out of their cubicles, get down to the post office, and do a good old-fashioned J. Edgar-style mail cover. So, it is inevitable that we are going to be monitored. The issue is how I handle that fact when I'm choosing content for the show. The problem, as I've said, is that this show, as tiny as it is our biggest propaganda tool. I checked the stat counter this morning, and it's pretty clear that barring any major setback or outage, we're definitely going to beat last year's 200,000 unique visitors. 200,000 people per year isn't too shabby an audience for a tiny show like this, although at one point, Bill White was getting 150,000 unique hits per month on Overthrow.com. Of course, White also filled Overthrow.com with all kinds of movement gossip, so he got goat dancers and weirdos galore. Now, the fact remains that there are things that the white listeners to this show need to hear, and which I can best convey by talking about them on this show, and things that the hostile listeners to the show don't need to hear. I need to choose between the two, and when there's a conflict, decide which is more important, that our friends hear something they need to hear, or our enemies don't hear something they don't need to hear. Now, if I mess up either way, I could be doing damage to the Northwest Independence Movement. Now, you will note that I very seldom discuss specific Northwest Front activities of any kind on this show. And when I do discuss specific activities, such as urging you folks to migrate to the Northwest or making CDs of these RFN podcasts, it's always something so squeaky clean legal that not even the most rabid, frothing-at-the-mouth Jew or nigger U.S. attorney can fabricate a conspiracy rap out of it. Well, not yet, anyway. Look, let me put it like this, as cliche as this may sound. Now, I'm not going to tell you guys that I think of every one of you as potential revolutionary leaders in the struggle for Northwest independence, because you're not. If you were potential leaders, you'd all be up here by now. But there's a good chance, an almost overwhelming chance, that here and there, among the more or less 6,000 of you who drop by every week now, there are a few of you guys who are potential leaders, one of whom may be that fabled national organizer I keep babbling about. And I need to reach out to you and start instructing you guys now, even before you make the decision to migrate home and devote yourself to the 14 words. Once again, I will tell you, we have to get rid of this idea that all of us, I think, seem to have at the back of our minds someplace, that someday there is going to be a big, huge, mass movement with the 21st century equivalent of the long brown columns of stormtroopers marching down the street like it was a Nuremberg rally. That is not going to happen. History is made by active minorities, and our task here is to recruit the active minority that will secure the existence of our people and a future for white children by creating the Northwest American Republic. Those are the people that I have to reach, and sometimes it means that in order to take a chance that I could reach somebody like that, I have to maybe say some things on here that might be left better unsaid. I suspect it will probably be a long time before we can make any real assessment as to just how effective or otherwise this show has been. Now, I have 40 years of experience in this movement clusterfuck that I desperately want to pass on to those of you who are capable of assimilating it and understanding it, so that you don't make the same mistakes I made or the same mistakes I've seen others make at close hand. Now, this show is where I have you all together once a week, and you're more or less listening, and so I have to take the chance that you will benefit from some of the things I say on here, more so than our enemies can find some way to use it to do us harm. Bluntly put, some of you guys are going to have to do this yourselves someday.
Good afternoon, comrades. I received quite a bit of feedback from the June 6, 2013 podcast, most of it along the lines of, "All right, I agree with what you said. So how do we go about digging ourselves out of this mess and recovering at least a portion of who we once were as a people in order to get this thing off the ground? Honestly, it's truly nothing more than Harold has already said. It starts with a choice. A choice to be different, to no longer conform to a world that says our destruction, the destruction of white people, must happen in order for the world to be good again. None of us has to look very deep inside to know that that's not true, that once we're gone, the world is lost. Who's responsible? The Jew, obviously. But we've all gone down the garden path the Jew was selling, only to find it infested with weeds further down. We all need to just stop and turn around. Yes, white men need to recover their courage, and white women need to stop competing with men and become white women again. But laying blame on each other isn't going to help. Just because your husband, wife, father, mother, brother, sister, friends, or whoever isn't doing what you can clearly see they need to be doing to get turned around and start rebuilding their honor and integrity and moral fiber, doesn't mean that's an excuse for you to shirk your own duty to do those things. Instead of worrying about who's responsible and therefore who should be making changes first, the better course would be to simply say, yep, it's wrong and it needs fixing, so let's each do the things we can do that are appropriate to our gender and role in society, and the rest will sort itself out once we have our own country. But what of the alpha gene that Harold says has been bred out of the white race, particularly white men, over the past century or so? Are we doomed to a world where white alpha males have all but been destroyed? Personally, I don't think so. I do think white men can recover, or reactivate actually, their alpha gene if they so choose. It would take a lot of work and a complete change of mindset. It would have to be a conscious choice from beginning to end, and would require a willingness to confront themselves head-on, admit where they've gone wrong or what's lacking in their lives, and make changes accordingly. And that applies to white women, too, finding the courage in themselves to return to the traditional role of wife and homemaker and stand up for their right to be that and more. As Harold has said so eloquently in his books, the Jew has hurled us headlong off our racial ship into the sea of mud, and those of us who are racially aware are trying desperately to climb back on that ship and rebuild our lives. Conscious choice is the key. Conscious choice in speech, dress, work, where we live, who we associate with, what we focus on, and how we live our lives. And that's a problem because it's easier to go with the flow than it is to turn around and wade back upstream to where we went wrong. Obviously, we can't go back to the way it was, and I don't think that's what we really want, since the Jew was part of that to some extent. But we can choose to stop thinking, talking, and acting like niggers and other muds and start becoming white men and women again. An example would be the fact that up until about 50 years or so ago, women wore dresses of one form or another their entire lives. It does not have to be complicated or difficult to do so. But just making that one change has the potential to change a woman's entire outlook on life. I apologize, an equivalent change men could make escapes me right now, but I think you get the idea. Where to start? Pick one, anyone, and start there. Like Andy says about packing the moving van and moving to the Northwest, do a little something every day. Make a choice and stick with that one thing until it's become your nature once again, then move on to something else. That's easier to do for some things than others. Obviously, giving up the nigger language would certainly be easier than reframing your whole moral universe to recover that alpha gene. But where you start is up to you, because even though we're all trying to get back on the same boat, we're all still individuals. We didn't have any choice about the world we were born into, but we do have control over how much we participate in it and conform to it. And yes, all of this is much easier said than done. Whatever you choose to do and however you choose to do it, there will always be massive distractions. There's no way out of certain things, such as earning a living and supporting your family, but others we could all do without entirely or on a much more limited basis, such as watching TV and focusing on sports or fashion or video games or just about anything else you can name, which takes us away from rebuilding our lives. Yes, we all need downtime and time to unwind, but there's a huge difference between watching a movie once in a while for relaxation and watching 3 or 4 hours of TV every night. I get that the TV does take our minds off the horrible world we live in, but that 3 or 4 hours could be used so much more productively, and I think you all know that. For those who are not already in the homeland, working on migration comes to mind. How are we ever going to get a country of our own and create a world where white people can flourish if we don't have the bodies to do it? It's time to stop making excuses for being the way we are and start doing what it takes to change. Step up to the plate, take a good long look at your life, figure out what you can change, and do that. We're white people. We can do anything we set our minds to if we choose to do so. The choice is yours. Hail victory.
Earlier this week, I sent out a link to a pro-Northwest Front video on YouTube that was done by a guy named Plasterman, and I called it an artistic video with the word artistic in quotes. This got a response from Comrade Jason in Oklahoma, who asked if I was being snide and calling the video effete, which was not my intention. I think those of you who saw the video can understand what I meant, but the overall thrust of Jason's complaint was that I might be seen as discouraging experimentation and creativity in NF propaganda. No, not at all, although I do have some ideas along those lines which I'll get into in a moment. But by all means, everybody needs to feel free to experiment. Now, I'm not some kind of Muhammad-like prophet who thinks that my way is the only way, and far be it for me to discourage initiative of any kind. Such as our first musical piece for this show. Now, this was sent to me by a totally new person on our list, presumably in England, and I don't know anything about him. The piece is called Sir Oswald Mosley, Revolutionary Fascist, and it's, well, a little bit off the beaten path, let's say. But see what you think of it. One critical comment from me. Once again, we're seeing a problem which is very common in our kind of music. Bad or unbalanced mixing, where the music is so loud in the background that you can't hear what the lyrics are saying. Now, I'm sure this isn't the creator's fault. I don't know what kind of software he was working with, but in racial music of any kind, the lyrics are actually more important than the instrumental track, because they are what give the song its white nationalist identity and content. That's just a comment for future reference. I'm not putting this comrade or his song down in any way. Right now, I think we need to award an A for effort to anyone who creates any kind of music for our side at all.
In Freiheit gesetzt und zugleich eben dadurch in die höchste Verbindlichkeit. In Freiheit gesetzt. Und zugleich eben dadurch in die höchste Verbindlichkeit.
A great new field for sweatshops to be opened up, so that these new industries which we're creating in Britain today will be destroyed as the old industries were. Simplified, rationalized machinery with a few white surveyors, and then the masses of cheap colored labor torn off the land and taken into the sweatshops to work and labor and cough their guts out with tuberculosis until they too are thrown on the spandrel. Is that worthy of Britain? Is that to be the future of Europe? And is this competition to be organized within our European brotherhood, bringing in these sweat fields in Africa into our Europe civilization, so that the financial power in one European country can use it against the financial power in another? All the great financial central power of the world, now shifted from the city of London to Wall Street, New York, shall be able, on the mass of money, of wealth and of power which it brings to it, again and again to exert its influence in politics, until, as you see today, it is childish nonsense to say that a British government rules Britain. It's nothing to do with British government or the British people. The government of the world is the financial government, the power of money and of money alone. Revolutionary conception of politics, of economics, and of life itself.
In June of 2010, North Idaho attorney Edgar J. Steele was arrested by the FBI on false charges of allegedly hiring a hitman to murder his wife and mother-in-law. The alleged assassin was a man named Larry Fairfax, an FBI informer who was inserted into Steele's home posing as a handyman in order to spy on the Steele family, until he saw the opportunity to help the Bureau destroy an outspoken critic of the regime. While he was working there, Fairfax proceeded to help himself to large stashes of silver coins and bullion that the Steeles were keeping on their property in anticipation of a Federal Reserve currency crash brought on by Barack Obama's incompetence. The final whereabouts of that silver seems to be something of a mystery. Apparently, the FBI allowed Fairfax to keep at least some of it as a kind of bonus or reparations for the annoyance and inconvenience of having to spend 16 months in a minimum security prison in the service of the Bureau. The basis of Edgar Steele's conviction were audio files fabricated by FBI technicians, supposedly discussions between himself and Fairfax about murder for hire. These conversations appear even to a layman who first hears them to sound strained, stilted, unnatural, and obviously doctored at the key points and phrases. The Steele tapes were not only forgeries, apparently they weren't even very good ones. At Steele's trial, two international audio engineering experts who were prepared to state categorically, for the record, that the tapes were fraudulent, were barred from testifying by a corrupt judge. The jury was never allowed to hear evidence which clearly proved Steele's innocence. The situation wasn't helped by the fact that Steele's first attorney, a federal public defender named Roger Peavin, was a raging alcoholic who at the time was being sued by three members of his own legal staff for various acts of drunken misconduct. Steele's second defense attorney, a man named Robert McAllister, on whom he and his wife Cindy expended most of their life savings, turned out to be facing disbarment for embezzling his client's money, and was in fact disbarred only weeks after Steele's conviction. Many suspect that this second attorney may have struck a deal with the government to keep himself out of prison by deliberately taking a dive in the courtroom and bungling Steele's defense. If so, it didn't work. In September of 2012, the 62-year-old McAllister was sentenced to 6 years for fraud. So there is some comfort in hoping that the bent brief may die in the same prison cell as the client he betrayed. Interestingly enough, McAllister himself was a former United States attorney and prosecutor, which gives you some idea of the typical moral character of the people in the federal judiciary. Now, for whatever reason, McAllister's performance in the courtroom was lackluster, to say the least, and he refused to put his client on the witness stand, which always looks very bad to a jury. Needless to say, the attorney's own perilous legal situation was never explained to either Ed or Cindy Steele while the trial was going on. As icing on the cake, I've spoken to persons present in the courtroom during the trial who told me that Ed Steele, quote-unquote, looked like a zombie, confused and disoriented, and he seemed to be completely incoherent and disconnected from what was going on around him. The consensus of opinion was that Steele was drugged on orders from someone in the federal government to make sure that he was incapable of assisting in his own defense or even understanding what was happening to him. No one knows for sure why the federal government of the United States did this horrible thing to Edgar Steele. He must have pissed somebody off real bad, although I don't see how. Ed had announced plans to run for governor of Idaho, but he subsequently withdrew from the governor's race due to ill health. I have this horrible suspicion that the whole ghastly business may simply have been some kind of grotesque experiment on the part of the FBI, simply to see how far they could go and how much they could get away with in arresting and destroying critics of the regime. Edgar Steele is being held, we think, in the Victorville facility, which is well known throughout the federal system as a kind of toilet where human beings are flushed away. Among other things, the water supply in the prison is known to be contaminated with carcinogens and toxic waste, which facilitates the decline in health of those federal prisoners whom the government wishes to hear no more of. Victorville is notorious as an end-of-the-line destination. Once the gates clang shut there, no one leaves except in a body bag. Edgar Steele has been sent there to die. No one has, in fact, personally heard from Edgar Steele in well over a year now. His mail has been simply disappearing without response. We don't know whether the prison authorities are just throwing it away or what. Now, there has been a small amount of information circulated within the white nationalist community to the effect that Edgar is still alive and there's still some kind of appeal pending, but he is definitely being held incommunicado by the dictatorship, as he was during the first 6 months after his initial arrest. I have reason to believe that there is more going on with Edgar Steele than we are being told, But we won't get into that now, lest people within the movement accuse me of quote-unquote starting rumors. I'm not quite sure how to approach this problem, especially in the complete vacuum of information that now exists. But the fact is that the prison authorities are completely lacking in credibility, and there is no way to tell what has happened to Ed. He may be in solitary, he may be in the infirmary, he may have been secretly moved to another prison, or he may be dead from his heart condition or because the dictatorship simply murdered him in his cell one night. We have no way of knowing. There are other things going on that it would be inadvisable for me to comment on, except to say that it is a matter of great urgency that somehow someone in the outside world needs to reestablish contact with Edgar Steele, although how this is to be done, I have no idea. I am now going to play for you another excerpt from one of the last podcasts that Edgar Steele made on March the 18th, 2010. A little under 3 months before the dictator's servants came in the dawn to end his life. They always seem to come at sunrise, by the way. I think someone told them that coming in the dark of night was bad optics. It's truly creepy to think that at the very time Edgar was sitting in his study making this recording, all the while the FBI informer Larry Fairfax was slinking around outside the house, looking for Ed and Cindy Steele's silver stash. Or perhaps Fairfax was peeping through a window while Ed is speaking here and maybe fiddling with the mini-recorder taped beneath his shirt that the Bureau had given him. You will note during this podcast how Mr. Steele comes out with the old no violence just yet thing and tells people how if you just live your life openly and you don't break the law, you'll be okay. Well, we all know how well that worked out for Ed. I still have no idea why the dictatorship decided to do what they did to Edgar Steele and not to me yet. Why Johnny Logan Spencer is in prison for a single poem, but I've gotten away with 5 novels. Why these people choose to destroy some dissidents and to ignore others. In a way, that's the scariest way to roll of all. When everything seems completely arbitrary, never knowing what the rules are or where the lines are. Now maybe they're just doing that deliberately as another form of institutional terrorism. Who the hell knows what goes on in the worm-eaten minds of the people who rule us?
Immigration. The American border with Mexico is a sieve. On the other hand, the American border outward is a Berlin Wall to its own citizens, who now require, in addition to passports and visas, permission from Homeland Security before being allowed to exit the country. Take a few minutes and watch the video at the URL embedded in the online transcript of tonight's Nickel Rant at this point. The same chart in that video about immigration is reproduced in the transcript. Note well that the date by which whites become a minority in America on that chart occurs well before mid-century. If you think things are unfair or rough right now, just wait until then. Already the mayors of border towns in Mexico are speaking of constructing a border fence to protect themselves from the gangs, robbers, and criminals now crossing over from America. This is just too rich. As always, truth is stranger than fiction. And I couldn't make something like this up, folks. Want to see what America will be like in the not-too-distant future? Dig up some old videos of those riots in South Central L.A. Pay particular attention to the footage of Reginald Denny being viciously attacked by hoodlum blacks in broad daylight, with the police doing nothing to intervene or provide him aid. Without the massive illegal immigration that Bush and now Obama are accommodating, immigration of the very worst people that Mexico and Latin America have to offer, America would have reached a level of steady population totals in the area of 250 million. Now we're headed upward on a steadily increasing curve of population growth already beyond the country's carrying capacity and headed for a level that will make America equal to all other third world nations. Obama now openly has promised amnesty to America's millions of illegal aliens, primarily Mexican, while his social services minions expand the availability to them of Social Security, Medicare, and a host of other social services designed to support deserving Americans. And who pays? You do, of course, and suffer the degradation and reduction of those very services being provided to your parents and, when needed, to yourself as well. Foreign relations. Foreign relations? What a joke! America fell from first in the world and beloved by all to last, hated more even than Israel, and during the term of a single president, arguably the worst president ever to disgrace the White House, George W. Bush. The U.S. dollar, once backed by gold and then oil, now is backed by raw military force. To ensure the dollar's hegemony, more is spent on America's war machine than is spent by all the other countries in the world combined. Use our dollar to conduct your business, we tell the nations of the world, particularly those selling oil, or we will come to your country, destroy your homes, and kill you. Just ask Iraq. Next up, Iran. After Iran will come America's ultimate and final foreign policy statement, World War III. I pray only that we can get through it without America's cities falling to nuclear strikes, but I see little chance of our escaping that outcome. Obama's first bailout, or economic stimulus package, was passed in record time by Congress due in large part to Obama's hysterical call for urgency in its adoption. As with Bush's bailout, not to mention Patriot Acts 1 and 2, the administration bill was passed without even being read by members of Congress. Bush had to threaten Congress with a declaration of martial law, but Obama's curt demand for swift action was enough. Even then, though Obama threatened the end of the world unless the bill was adopted immediately, he then took a leisurely 3 days before he signed off on it at a politically opportune time and place. So much for the national good as motivation. Now, the current national budget, too, has been adopted and signed whole cloth, though embedded with nearly 10,000 pork barrel earmarks, the very thing that Obama promised he would refuse to approve when campaigning for our votes. So much for Obama's attention to his campaign promises, as if his actions in the Middle East had not already put the lie to them. Already they're talking about Obama's next bailout package. We've yet to address the economic plight of state, county, and local governments, the bailing out of which will make the Wall Street bailouts seem like a pittance. Remember, all this bailout money springs from debt, largely created as if by magic by the not-federal, no-reserve non-bank. Remember also that every dollar created in this fashion lessens the purchasing power of the dollars you might have left. This is the magic of economic redistribution in action. Redistribution from you to the pockets of Wall Street bankers. Excessive debt and money creation due to feckless spending is what got us in our current plight. Creating more of it to cure the problem is precisely like spraying gasoline on a fire in an attempt to douse it. The result will be more taxes, more debt, and more inflation. Lots more inflation, leading to more lost jobs, more homelessness, and more hunger throughout America. Can the street riots be far behind? By now, followers of my rants understand that price inflation, which clearly is running well over 10% per year, and in fact is about 15% by now and on track to exceed 20% by the end of this year. Who you gonna believe? Asked Whirly Ben Bernanke. Me or your own lying eyes? Anyway, followers of my rants understand that price inflation is a monetary symptom, not an independent phenomenon. It happens because the foxes whom we put in charge of our henhouse are busy gorging themselves on our chickens. They simply print money, whether on paper or electrons, debit cash, credit debt, our debt, their cash. When they started to get really out of control with their money creation scheme, which is a crime called counterfeiting if you or I do it, they simply stopped telling us about how much money they were creating. M3, the most useful measure of the money supply. But you can get a private assessment of this key figure, which is running, as I said, at over 15% today at www.nowonfutures.com. Today, they claim that inflation is running only 2 to 3%. Who are you going to believe? Them or your own lying eyes? Inflation, housing, jobs, debt, trade deficit, they all are much worse than they tell you. So naturally, what is the government going to do about it? Stop telling us, of course. The national debt keeps growing, fueled by the insane war in the Middle East. What's going to cut it? We don't have any manufacturing base left in America. Those interest rate cuts you keep hearing about, they help the bankers, not us. You won't see them. They keep the banks from going under, where they belong. Market manipulation saves the bank, not us. They keep crowing about how they're fixing things. What they're doing is making things worse, of course, guaranteeing that Depression 2 will make Depression 1 look like a walk in the park. And that means war, of course. So they can distract us from what they have done and have someone else to blame. That means more privation and more of our children dead. You know by now that your house has declined in value, up to 70% in some parts of the country. Overall, it still looks like at least a 90% total decline in American real estate value to me, measured from a couple years ago until a couple of years from now, 50% from inflation and 40% from nominal price declines. There's at least a 20 to 25% decline already built into the inflation rate during the next 2 years, just like the 2 years we just finished. 4 years means a 50% decline from inflation alone, with prices not moving down at all, but move down they have, and move down more they will. All we need is another 10 to 20% decline on top of the 50% erosion in value caused by inflation, and real estate will hit the levels of Depression 1, with properties worth in reality only 10 cents on the dollar. Imagine, if only we had sold out and rented 2 or 3 years ago, putting the proceeds into gold or silver, already we'd be up 100% on the investment, and we would have saved the 30 to 40% decline in our existing property value. In other words, if your place was worth $1 million in 2005 and you had sold, today you'd have over $2 million in shiny metal. You'd be renting an even more palatial residence for a nominal amount, and 2 years from now, you could buy back your old place for perhaps $400,000, paid for from your $4 million stash. Net result, you have your same house and $3.5 million that you otherwise would not have had, simply because real estate declined by a total of 90% in that time period. Of course, bread will cost $6 per loaf, but $3.5 million is a lot of bread. Instead, most of us traded our home equity for cars and trips and boats and other things. Now we're maxing out our credit cards simply to put food on the table, while the value of our homes drops beneath what we owe on it. Next, we sell our things to pay for the food. This is just how Depression 1 progressed. Meanwhile, our own food is being bid up by international forces as the dollar dwindles in significance. Soon, we will have to choose between mortgage payments and dinner for the kids. This, too, is how Depression 1 progressed. This is precisely how one becomes homeless. If the normal person was capable of doing the math, or even believing folks like thee and me, there would be blood in the streets tonight. Just as there should be, with politicians, plutocrats, bankers, media moguls, and neocons aplenty hanging from lamp poles all across America. But the normal person is too busy watching Jeopardy tonight. Tomorrow we'll bring a different story.
Got an email from a guy in Great Britain calling himself Charles of Wales. Dear Harold, if people are complaining that you play too much Irish music, why not play some Welsh music? Attached is an MP3 of the Great Songmen of Harlech, if you would care to play it on the show. Signed, Charles. Okay, well, why not? Some of you may remember, actually, this was the song that the 24th South Wales Borderers sang in the movie Zulu.
Tongues of fire on Idris flaring, news of foe many declaring, to heroic and children flying, o'er the distance Argyll crying, for you, Harlech men. Shovers of waves on wailing, now in a band of bailing, youths who rouse, who never, yes, in battles are failing. This our answer, crowds down pouring, sweet.
Seriously, for those of you unreconstructed Orangemen out there who believe that I'm too Irish in my outlook and pro-Catholic and so forth and so on, I'm not really. I really did live in the islands for 5 years, and I know that there are two sides to the story there. In fact, here's the Honorable Charles Bingham, 7th Earl of Lucan, with a conspiratorial blast from the past, a good old-fashioned rant on the Popish plot. Boy, ain't that a trip down memory lane. Now, what can I say? Lord Lucan has a weakness for the classics.
The Irish Massacre started on October the 23rd of 1641 and continued for several months, and at least 40,000 Presbyterians were murdered. Some put the number at 200,000. The King of England who supported that massacre was Charles I. Now, the Mayflower sailed from Plymouth to New England about 20 years earlier, and the purpose was to escape from the persecution of England. It is this massacre that is missing from the United Kingdom's textbooks or the English Civil War. Because, according to 1984, if you can rewrite history, you can change the future. The Ministry of Truth does not want anyone to know the real reason for the English Civil War, so as to prevent the reoccurrence of a civil war where they end up being losers. The American Revolution is really a continuation of the English Civil War. By the time of the American Revolution, the Royalists had become known as the Tories. We all know that the indigenous people of Europe are being replaced by dangerous immigrants, and the loony left hasn't got the brains to oppose the invasion of such dangerous immigrants. But if you know the real history of the immigrant invasion, it was started by the Tories. That is right. The immigrant invasion is the work of so-called conservatives. The destruction of Western civilization cannot be the work of stupid left-wingers. It has to be the work of right-wingers, such as Rockefeller. He proposes the coming of an Armageddon, whereby every man's hand will be against his neighbor, and he ends it by suggesting that only the meek will survive. In a religious war, such as the Irish Massacre, people were not slaughtered because of they were arrogant, leaving only the meek as survivors. They were slaughtered for their beliefs. Islam is slaughtering people over the planet, not because they are arrogant, but because they do not believe in Islam. And the Catholic Church did the same thing. People were slaughtered for what they believed or did not believe. If we have a race war, you will be killed according to your race. It matters not whether you are arrogant or whether you are meek. The only thing will matter will be your race. If, for instance, a race war were to break out in Germany, in order to survive, you had better look like a German. If you do not look like a German, and a race war breaks out in Germany, you had better get out of Germany while the getting is good. Now, years ago, I prophesied the fall of the Berlin Wall and sent a letter to Ronald Reagan. The laws of nature are iron laws. They cannot be made illegal by any human government. The immigrant invasion cannot last much longer. No longer than 3 decades can the governments of Europe, America, prevent the laws of nature from becoming reality. Years ago, a prophet prophesied the fall of Jerusalem, and in it he said that the hatred of the Romans will be so intense that not a stone will be left upon a stone and not torn down. Europe is definitely headed in that direction. Now, the extermination of the white race in Europe is only taking place slowly, but the reaction will be violent. In fact, extremely violent. Anders Breivik is only the tip of the iceberg. In fact, the hatred will be so intense, the youth of Europe will even kill their own parents. Yes, parents are violating the inheritance rights of their own children. The left says that you have to feel sorry for poor people. But poor people, who are not part of my family? Horse manure. The law of nature is simple, survival of the fittest. The law of survival permits the breaking of all laws. The white race may be the most peaceful of all races. Or is it? We evolved during an ice age, when conditions were extremely brutal. We survived by being social and working together, but socialism extended only to others living in the same cave. We white people invented the machine gun, whereas the Chinese, who discovered gunpowder, made it into firecrackers. Besides that, when we did live in the caves, we invented the most advanced stone-headed spear. Now, if you are young and listen to this broadcast, a revolution takes planning and preparation. The American Revolution was seeded by Rousseau, who wrote The Social Contract, and Thomas Paine, who wrote Common Sense. the Sons of Liberty planned the dumping of tea into the Boston Harbor. It takes the formation of secret organizations that can and will execute traitors. Now, one of the most successful secret orders is the Side of Jesus, known as the Jesuits. The Jesuits have assassinated kings and presidents. The famous doctrine of the Jesuits is the end is justified by the means, which, of course, is also the doctrine of the Communist Party. Establishing a political movement in this day and age that requires internet access and cell phone communications and membership dues is total stupidity. You establish a secret society through invitations. You never use a website or organize rallies or public speaking, because those that make legal revolution impossible make violent revolution inevitable. So why should evolutionists support Protestantism? Because there will be no such thing as science, and therefore no such thing as Charles Darwin's discovery of evolution. Without Calvin or Martin Luther, there will be no such thing as the Geneva Bible, or the pilgrims that fled to New England and founded America. History teaches us that any new religion or philosophy will be persecuted by the old stick-in-the-muds. And not only persecuted, but massacred by the old stick-in-the-muds, as in the Irish Massacre, which made an English and Scottish Civil War necessary. And yes, we who live in this day and age need to realize that we are headed towards another civil war, because the old stick-in-the-muds will not give up their current false beliefs that we still have a constitution, and that all men were created equal, and we are no longer living in 1776.
Okay, rather than give you guys one long speech at this point in the program like I usually do, there are a number of short items that people seem to want me to comment on, so we'll get right on those now, in no particular order of significance. Now, first off, I have received a number of emails to the effect of, "Dear Harold, what do you think of the ongoing Edward Snowden drama and the revelations he's made about the National Security Agency and other Obama spook outfits spying on Americans and gathering up and archiving our phone calls and emails? Looks like you were right all along." Yes, of course I was right, but it's not like this domestic spying thing was any big secret. Everybody and his dog knew about it, including the media. They just chose to ignore it and not discuss it in public in front of the children, because a liberal democratic dictatorship was doing it. Now, you can bet your bippy that if a Republican had been caught out doing one-tenth of any of Obama's crap, the media's screams would have shaken the very heavens. Everybody in this country with any remote, tenuous connection to the computer or internet or IT industry has known since October of 2001 that the FBI is intercepting and archiving every single email sent in this country, from everybody to anybody. That was when they first installed the Carnivore program on every American ISP, and it didn't work at first, so for a few days in October of that year, almost nobody could get connected to the internet, remember? The thing with the NSA, and almost certainly the DHS, FBI, and CIA as well, monitoring and archiving phone calls is pretty much the same situation. They call it metadata. Edward Snowden did not reveal anything we didn't already know. It's just that he slipped by the media blackout because certain media people were outraged when the Obama dictatorship was caught spying on them. Interestingly enough, it has also been recently revealed that Barry has been killing people with drones again, an unknown number of them in unknown places, and that one of the ways he, or rather his Jewish handlers, select a target for aerial murder is through the use of this very kind of metadata, which the spook agencies are now accumulating, data that shows who's calling, what people, where, and how long they talk, and so forth and so on. It now appears that for someone to get whacked by presidential decree, all that's necessary is for some geeky intelligence analyst sitting in a cubicle somewhere to point out that so-and-so called somebody else 12 times in the past week, and since we all know that somebody else is a deeply evil and suspect individual, then someone A needs to be blown to smithereens while he's walking down the street. Now, so far as we know, this isn't being done in the United States as yet, although it is being done to American citizens, just overseas, at least that's what they tell us. But then it's more likely that American targets within the continental U.S. wouldn't be hit with drones, because that would be kind of hard to cover up if some guy's suburban McMansion gets blown up in the middle of the night. American targets are probably just taken out in the normal intelligence agency gangster style, through induced heart attacks like Andrew Breitbart, or mysterious single-car crashes like left-wing journalist Michael Hastings a couple of weeks ago. Apparently, a few hours before his death, Hastings sent an email to his contacts telling them that our friends in the silk suits were sleazing around his friends and business acquaintances, gathering information on him. Apparently, the FBI were trying to locate one of his sources, and when Hastings wouldn't play ball with Obama, very shortly thereafter, he just wraps his car around the telephone pole at 4 a.m. No traffic, good weather and visibility. No drugs or alcohol in Hastings' system. Just bang, you're dead. I suspect that in a few years, Barry and the Democrats will just send a SWAT team or a couple of FBI agents to shoot somebody in the head when they answer the door. You guys do realize that would be perfectly legal right now under current laws like that 2011 National Defense Authorization Act. I guess that Barry, or whoever's running Barry, just doesn't want to be that blatant about it for the moment, but by 2016, who's going to give a damn? You see, this is what happens when you have a regime and a secret police who understand full well that they can do anything they want, and nothing will be done about it. All right, on to another topic, which I suppose might fall into the category of housekeeping. The Northwest Front is getting more and more migration inquiries than ever before via email and the websites and blogs, although, inevitably, most of these contactees turn out to be just looky-loos, who never actually migrate. And I suppose that's just human nature. However, there's another kind of migration inquiry that I need to discuss right now. Now, this has actually come up several times during the past few weeks. I don't know why, but anyway, let me see if I can find a way to put this courteously and diplomatically. Now, you guys need to understand, if you don't, that when I speak of migration to the Northwest, I mean you coming here on your own, using your own assets to establish yourself in a new life, in a new land, like the pioneers did. You do understand, don't you, that the degree of help that we can give you does not include money, guaranteed employment, or guaranteed housing. You need to understand that you must not simply rock up here at SeaTac Airport, sight unseen, and expect to be taken in and put up in the guest room of people who have never seen hide nor hair of you before. You have to understand that nobody can walk in here off the internet and get slapped down right in the center of things and given the keys to the kingdom. Yes, I know, Pastor Butler's Aryan Nations compound in Hayden Lake was as famous for its open bunkhouse and refrigerator full of beer as it was for its gatherings. And that's what lost Pastor Butler his home and lost us a property which was very important as a symbol. Now, toward the end of his life at Hayden Lake, the situation completely slipped out of his control, and he ended up running what was basically a halfway house for derelicts. And that situation turned on him and bit him bad. Now, as the situation in North America changes, I can foresee a time when the Northwest Front may indeed become involved in the accommodation business and find itself setting up bunkhouses and barracks and finding family homes for people, etc. But we're talking about when the balloon goes up, as right-wingers say. And all of a sudden, then we're going to have tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of white people fleeing to the Northwest, just like the Horakova family in Freedom's Sons. Now, right now, we simply don't have the resources to provide free much of anything to anybody. More importantly, we are in the process of establishing a protocol or system to examine potential recruits very thoroughly, much more so than heretofore, to make sure that sketchy people don't get close, because as was inevitable, as the NF grows in movement awareness, and we get more and more hits every week on the website, sketchy people are starting to be attracted to us and come buzzing around. This does not bode well for those who think that they're going to just rock up here and be taken into somebody's home like a stray kitten. Not happening, people. This is why I emphasize yet again the necessity of the scouting trip, wherein you come here first and look over the part of the homeland wherein you wish to settle, and we get to look you over. Frankly, if you are really so poor that you can't afford a scouting trip even by Greyhound bus, and yes, people have come here by bus before, then you need to concentrate on getting your act squared away where you are so that you can begin saving for your scouting trip and migration. I once had a couple of guys tell me that they were migrating, and they asked me about the quality of the homeless shelters in the area. Come on, guys. You're no good to the Republic or the party or yourselves if you can't even function in society. I suppose you might say that is the basic requirement for every potential Northwest migrant. You can't be a drag on us, you can't be a drag on your community, you can't be a drag on your family. You have to be functional in society. You have to contribute something. We are trying to build a new nation on the face of the earth here, not open a flophouse. Okay, I promised you British listeners last week that I'd play you some Ulster Loyalist music, if you'd send me some. Well, nobody did, but I do have some from previous podcasts. Now, what I'd really like would be if some of you guys can point me to a collection of downloadable MP3 files of some really good Orange Flute band cuts, especially numbers with a lot of lambeg power in them. If you know where I can find anything like that, let me know. Anyway, I was going to save this one for the Glorious 12th in a few weeks, but here it is early. King Billy's on the wall. And indeed he is, on a lot of walls all across Northern Ireland.
There's a famous painting now that everybody knows. It stands upon a gable wall over Sandy Road. In memory of King William and Brotherhood is joined. They fought for our deliverance at the Battle of the Boyne. King Billy's on the wall, King Billy's on the wall. He stands so high, he shines so bright, he lights up the falls. There's millions come to see him, they stand and gaze in awe. They remember 1690, King Billy's on the wall. Well, there are slogans painted in red, white, and blue. They tell the Pope where he can go and what he can do. There's one to Jared Rice, well, that's a different class. Go stick the lower armor on and stick it up your ass. King Billy's on the wall, King Billy's on the wall. He stands so high, he shines so bright, he lights up the falls. There's millions come to see him, they stand and gaze in awe. They remember 1690, King Billy's on the wall. Well, the next time you're in Ulster, won't you come and have a look? Stand beside that mural and have your photo too. Then put it on your mantelpiece or hang it in your hall, so that all the world can see King Billy's on the wall. King Billy's on the wall, King Billy's on the wall. He stands so high, he shines so bright, he lights up the falls. There's millions come to see him, they stand and gaze in awe. They remember 1690, King Billy's on the wall. King Billy's on the wall, King Billy's on the wall. He stands so high, he shines so bright, he lights up the falls. There's millions come to see him, they stand and gaze in awe. They remember 1690, King Billy's on the wall. So bright, he lights up the falls. There's millions come to see him, they stand and gaze in awe. They remember 1690, King Billy's on the wall.
Tell you what, rather than close out this week with some long impassioned tirade or deep philosophical discussion, I'll just leave you guys with a quick tip for local revolutionary activists. One of the main symptoms of this society's disease is the proliferation of weak, arrogant, incompetent, and silly people in positions of petty power over other people's lives. Bureaucrats, supervisors, teachers, thugs from the badly misnamed Child Protective Services agencies, attorneys, judges, administrators of various kinds, the 101 little commissars of political correctness that white males and increasingly white females as well have to put up with in their day-to-day existence. Most white people probably don't bear any kind of personal grudge against, say, President Obama or Nancy Pelosi or Jesse Jackson, just a generalized and impersonal resentment. These are celebrity figures far above their personal orbits, and in most cases there's a disconnect. Barry isn't really seen as a real person, he's just someone you see on TV, if you get my meaning. But affirmative action and political correctness hits a lot closer to home. The asshole supervisor at work, the stupid nigger clerk at the grocery store, Apu in the turban behind the counter at the DMV, the Mexicans who visibly take white people's jobs, the ex's vicious attorney, the judge who never listens. All of this puts a human face on the evil. I believe that in the long run, what will push white people over the edge into rebellion, some of us anyway, is not so much the big earth-shaking issues like war and peace or immigration, amnesty, or even Obamacare as such. It will be the petty PC, the little things that annoy the living crap out of normal people every day, like getting shoved out into the cold in the rain if you want to smoke a cigarette, like constantly being afraid to use certain words or say what you think, and constantly having to look over your shoulder to see if anybody's listening before you say anything that might be a little bit dubious. Always having to pretend to support PC garbage, like AIDS walkathons in your workplace because you're afraid that your attitude will be noticed, so forth and so on. Use this in your grassroots work. Let white people know that our victory means that all those monkeys will be ripped off their backs and punished for what they've done. Always try to slip that in. Once white people have a country of our own, we will finally be able to pick up a baseball bat or a gun if we feel like it and get these bastards. Catch them without big, strong, steroid-pumped muscle man police to protect them. Just you and them together for a quiet word of prayer. A personal revenge is going to be a major motive in our initial recruiting. It is humanly understandable, and to me anyway, it's a perfectly acceptable motive at first. Use personal wrongs as a hook to get people in and get them in a frame of mind so that they'll listen to the ideological stuff, then educate them from there so that they know why all this has happened. Anyway, time's up now, so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98104. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha on the Bon. Freedom.
Still is beating heart.